science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Zakowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher and your host. You probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker, from social media. They're the science dogs. This show takes what's best from their account and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take a look at something timely in science and do a deep dive into some pet science. We also have an expert guest who enthralls us and educates us with their knowledge in their area of science. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning into this week's podcast. Although it's a little later, I appreciate your patience. We had a heck of a drive getting back from the coast, and because we were in such an area where the Wi-Fi was really bad, there was no way I could do any of the finishing touches on the podcast, so thanks for your patience. We got a lot of rest and relaxation in one of the most beautiful places in Canada, the West Coast. For those of you who were wondering how we got out there safely with COVID, we stayed in a little cabin. We brought all our own food, so we did not interact with anybody besides our family. The only time we stopped, obviously, was for gas. So we tried our best to minimize our exposure, and we wore masks when we had to get gas. Or use washrooms. That area of Canada is really sparsely populated. And on the beaches, there might be only, 30 people on beaches that stretch for kilometers. So I felt pretty safe. And we've done a really good job up to this point of limiting our exposure. So I think it was a good calculated risk to actually give ourselves a mental boost before Chris and I head back to the classroom. This week in science news, we're going to be taking a look at COVID and kids, just because it's really timely. I know the Americans maybe have gone back to school in August. The Canadian kids go back in September. In pet science, we're going to look at the magnetic field of the earth and dogs. That's a pretty awesome article. Our guest is the effervescent and hilarious Jada Alcock, who runs hilarious TikTok videos and is a scientist herself. A smaller section at the end rounds out this podcast. No woo or wow, but we do have some family stories from our trip. Hey dogs, how did the shark plead in the murder case? Not guilty. Because sharks have gills. All right, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at the recommendations that a lot of different epidemiologists have for school. This is a really timely article. I know people are having their kids go back to school. There's some parents that listen to the podcast. There are a lot of educators that listen to the podcast. Chris and I both teach school. I am a high school teacher and she teaches middle school. Where I'm getting the recommendations, just to talk about the science and the risk, is from one's from the American Academy of Pediatrics and also the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. So the first question they raise is, at what level, or is there a safe level for COVID-19 to reopen schools? Both concluded, as well as other epidemiologists, that school reflects what's happening in the community. So communities that have high COVID-19 levels, that means there's more risk for kids going back to school in those communities, because if you have high levels in the community, chances are you'll have high levels in kids. The World Health Organization that both these groups used in their recommendation stated that SARS-CoV-2 should be testing at a less than 5% of the population for the previous 2 weeks for school to open. Now, for Canada, that's every province. We are well under 5% positive. Even though the numbers in Alberta went up a little bit a couple weeks ago, we're way below 5%. So that means, based on this, we can reopen schools. Now, what does that look like for our American friends? Well, there are a lot of states that are way over 5%. There are some states that are over 20%. Right there is a risk factor for it spreading. Just to name a couple, you've got, the big ones in the states right now are Florida, Arizona, Texas, right? All of those have percentages above actually 10%. Some are closer to 20. Florida's just under 20%. So it's well above even the most generous 5 to 10% that the WHO has recommended. Now, other schools have been opened up in other countries and they've done some unique things. Even though their levels are well below 5%, Denmark and Norway have cut their class sizes in half. Israel opened up normally, and Israel had a spread well under 5%, but it spread rapidly, and there was a huge outbreak during a heat wave because they were allowing kids to take off their masks. Another thing that's coming out, and there's more information every day about, is can kids transmit the virus at school? Can kids give it to other kids? Can kids give it to teachers? We can actually look at other places in the world that had COVID before North America, and South Korea has a really good study. They found among a 60,000 strong group that kids aged, well, not even kids, kids to young adults, kids to 10 and to 19, transmit the virus more likely than adults. More likely. But kids under 10 were less likely to pass it on. Now, there's a lot of questions as to why that is. I teach high school. I kind of know how why kids would be more likely in the upper grade to pass the virus is they are more social. They talk really close to each other. They hang off of each other. You have kids who are starting to date for the first time and all the kissy-kissy that goes with that. They share drinks. They share chapstick. They share lipstick. Like, they're gross. I call kids out on it all the time. I'm like, you're going to give the flu to everybody. The one thing that made me crazy that kids always do is they share a can of pop or soda pop, right? Like from the machine. They'll take a swig and then another kid will take a swig right from the same thing. Like, oh my goodness, disgusting. One of the things the study kind of emphasized why kids under 10 maybe are more safe in spreading the virus, that they're not as likely to spread the virus, is they don't cough as hard. So even though, you know, little kids are sick all the time, their little lungs don't push the air out enough to infect people around them. This even argued that the protein that the virus uses to hijack our cells, the ACE2 protein, I talked about that a couple podcasts ago, that protein may not be developed in little kids, and thus the virus has a lot harder time to attach. Another thing that is important to remember is that one of the recommendations is if you have higher positive tests, or even if you want to open schools, even if your test results aren't as high, is you should stagger school opening. That's one of the recommendations. Some of the European schools have done that, where they said, okay, kids from grade 1 to grade 5, go back for the first couple weeks to see how things are going, and then they slowly move in the rest of the other kids, right? So they might have middle school kids next and then high school kids last. Or they're using less contact. So they have a blended approach where kids go some days, and then on other days they have at-home learning, like what happened for all of us with kids and all of us teachers when everything got shut down with COVID. Another recommendation that they have is that kids should be taught in bubbles or pods or cohorts. And that's just to keep the contact small between a group that's easily traceable if there are positive results for COVID. It's easier to track exposure when you have 15 to 20 kids that don't interact with any other kids in a day. That is the huge problem all across North America because, well, and this is what they say is probably the safest, is to keep contact low. You're going to have to hire twice the amount of teachers, like an absolutely enormous amount of teachers. All the epidemiologists constantly say it's really important to have kids back in school, but the smaller the bubble, the better. The smaller the cohort, the safer the kids and the teacher. Now, these bubbles or these cohorts fall apart outside of the school. It's all fine to have, let's say I've got a cohort, and it doesn't really work for high school, right? Because kids have to go from different teacher to different teacher. Like, I teach chemistry and science. I don't teach them the kids math, or I don't teach them language or phys ed. So this is a big problem for high school kids. They have to move themselves around. But for elementary and middle school kids within their bubble, the teachers can potentially teach all the different subjects. So you have this little pod of kids, but outside of your pod, once the kids get on the bus and they go home, and if they're like they're having a play date or their soccer's opened up again, that entire system is foiled. So a cohort or bubble system requires the parents and the school to work together. Two more things that is really important in schools to stop the spread of COVID is airflow. If your school doesn't have great circulation, and kids are, it's like basically being on a plane or a cruise ship, you're constantly breathing in and out the air of everybody else, that increases your risk. What they found with the protests for Black Lives Matter all across North America was there wasn't a huge increase in infection. It wasn't from that, because the protests were held outside, and air current is the best ventilation system you could possibly have. So one of the things they recommend is teach have kids learn outside. Now, that's okay in lots of places. I don't know. It might be really hard in Arizona, for example, because it's going to be too hot in the middle of the day. But Canada has a bit of a problem with teaching outside, say, in November, December, January, February, March, probably April, when it's snow and possibly in the colder months, way too cold for any sane person to be outside. I don't want to be out there in my parka, in my survival suit, and my coffee's freezing trying to teach the kids. Lastly, the big one is physical distance. If you can keep people apart by 6 feet, that's the best you possibly can do. That's the big recommendation from the groups. That's a big recommendation from the WHO, the CDC, Health Canada. But the problem is you need to have the space. And when Chris and I go back, there's going to be no changes in class size. Now, the risk is low based on that first point, right? Alberta, where we teach, we don't have very high incidence of community positive infection rates. But like my class sizes are huge in high school, like 32, 34, 35 kids, sometimes higher. And I'm not going to get a different classroom. They're all going to get put in the same classroom. Another really good point is to clean everything, to sanitize everything. So that's one good thing that I know Alberta has announced, is that they're going to have increased cleaning throughout the day. My guess is that if they're having the high school kids move from class to class, when a kid comes into a room, they're going to be cleaning their own desk to, you know, to get rid of any kind of like droplet dispersion that landed on the desk that they could get infected by. Soapy water still is the best way to get rid of coronavirus. And hand sanitizer, of course, is much more convenient, but cleaning everything also helps. So if you're wondering about the science and the recommendations for kids in school, this has been the top 5 to 6 ideas to keep kids safe. Some of them are relatively cheap. Some of them, like decreasing class size and decreasing your pod or cohort size, are incredibly expensive because you need to double the amount of teachers, adults, that are responsible for those kids, or run a blended option where some kids come one day, some kids come the other. Anyways, it's going to be, I mean, this is the start of August when you're listening to this. So by middle of August, end of August, we'll have a whole bunch of data from all over the world in the United States. And that's about when Canada is going to decide to open up its schools. So it'll be interesting to see if our recommendations change based on what's happening in the rest of the world. So if you've got kids in school, the two things that you can do to keep your kids safe that the school districts can't help you with is make sure they're washing their hands, and if they can wear a mask, make sure they're wearing a mask. That's science news for this week. Today in Pet Science, we're going to look at the magnetic fields of the Earth and dogs. So you might have heard or seen videos of how different animals on Earth use our magnetic field lines to do various things. There's an adorable one of an Arctic fox dive bombing into the snow to get some kind of like little critter that's down there. And the foxes seem to align themselves with these magnetic lines. Whales use them, birds use them for migration. But in this new study, it appears that hunting dogs use them as well. Okay, so let's slow down and just talk just really quickly, because magnetic fields are wicked, wicked complicated. Well, we're not going to go into too great a detail because they're actually quite complicated and confusing, and that's really physics and outside my realm of expertise. But basically, the easiest way to explain it is the core of the Earth is solid. And the outer core, we got two cores, the inner core and the outer core, and the outer core is molten. As the Earth rotates, this molten core churns. It creates these convection currents. And within our core, you'd have molten iron and nickel. Now, this creates something called a geodynamo. So basically, the core of the Earth and the revolution of the Earth as it spins and orbits and everything creates this crazy powerful magnetic field. And that's great for us on Earth because the magnetic field on Earth shields us from all of these rays from the sun and from outer space that could take us out and kill us. If you want to picture a bar magnet that runs through the center of the Earth from the North Pole to the South Pole, sort of, there are these magnetic lines that spiral out, kind of like little half moons or half circles. And these are the lines we're going to be talking about with hunting dogs. These are the lines that birds can get in tune with, and they use them for their migration patterns. This is totally beyond our experience. We don't feel these or see these to any extent. They're invisible to us. But it appears not that way for dogs. This amazing ability is called magnetoreception. And a new study out of the Czech Republic in the journal eLife suggests or seems to show that hunting dogs can tap into this. This study builds on a whole bunch of research that has already been done about dogs and magnetic fields from the Czech Republic. Benediktova, Berda. These scientists found that a bunch of different breeds of dogs prefer to poop along magnetic lines with their body on the line for magnetic north to south, the north to south axis. And they theorize that the reason why they poop like this and why they have this behavior is it maps their location to other spots. Like it basically gives them a starting point. So Benediktova and her colleagues looked at hunting dogs, and the hunting dogs have this ability to home in on things, which really isn't fully understood. We know a bloodhound has an incredible sense of smell, but it may be not just the sense of smell that gives them this tracking superpower. Hunting dogs have been bred over our lifetimes to be the perfect companion to find something, track it down if it's been wounded, and also come back to the humans if they've gotten too far away. That's what they were looking at, is these hunting dogs can find their owner after running after prey in the middle of a forest with ease. and because the human hasn't gone forward, they haven't left their scent behind. I don't know if you're following this, so a hunter shoots a thing and the thing runs away and the dog goes after it. Maybe the thing has died. Maybe the dog has lost it. But the human is not fast enough, so the human is maybe way well back. But these hunting dogs are able to find their way back to their owner. So the researchers did this really cool study. They took these hunting dogs, 27 hunting dogs of 10 different breeds, from terriers to dachshunds, and they put trackers on them, GPS trackers. Now, they let the dogs out in a forested area away from everything. Buildings, roads, Starbucks, power lines, you name it. They were out in the middle of nowhere, and they ran away and they came back. And the trips that the dogs took about 30 to 90 minutes. Now, the owners hid close to the location where the dog was released. After a whole bunch of different trips in many different locations, 600 different trips in 60 different locations, they compiled the data. What they found was super interesting. Most dogs used their own scent to take the same route back. So the dog went away and then used its own smell on the way back. And that's what the GPS trackers clearly show. The dog went that way and went back basically along the same path that it took. Might have meandered a bit, might have got distracted, who knows. But it came back relatively the same pathway. But in hundreds of excursions, the dogs took a weird way back called scouting. The researchers looked at the data from the scouting trips, and they found that dogs were running along Earth's north-south magnetic field axis. This was dubbed a compass run, and it was no coincidence. They were using the magnetic fields of the Earth. This is fascinating because it's basically like having a biological compass in your brain, and you can sense where about you are in the world based on feeling out these magnetic fields. The other thing that was fascinating is that the scouting dogs using the magnetic fields, the magnetic lines of the Earth, came back way faster. Benediktova was so excited. Her quote is, "When we found out an unexpected magnetic behavior in the dog scouting activities, they were so excited." So these hunting dogs, they roam out long distances. Some use their nose to get back, but it really seems that some, a third, use the magnetic fields of the Earth. I think that's so cool. That puts them in the same category as birds in migration and the dive bombing Arctic foxes. That's pet science for this week. Before we get to the interview section, I just want to tell everybody a little bit about how the podcast is made possible. It's made possible, you can't see me pointing, but it's made possible by people just like you. If you've been listening to the show and you like the content, consider signing up on our Patreon page as a patron. The podcast, unfortunately, isn't free to run, even though we really enjoy doing it. It's been a great addition to our lives. To share more in-depth science news than our Twitter accounts and definitely Instagram can allow. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/BunsenBurner, and there are four tiers of support. If you head over there, you can see the different monetary amounts, but the lowest one is only $5 a month. That's not that bad. We do about four or five shows a month. Four shows, great education and entertainment for $5. Can't beat it. Plus, we send out perks. The other way the show makes money is through merchandise sales. We've worked with a cartoonist to deliver some amazingly adorable merchandise on our merchandise shop, and that's at www.BunsenBurnerBMD.com. The links are in the show notes, and you can peruse the adorable merchandise. Thanks, guys. Now on to the interview. On the Science Podcast, in the Ask an Expert section, I am just tickled to have Jada Elcock with me tonight. She is an incoming grad student in the Aquatic Fisheries Program. How are you doing today, Jada?
I'm so good. How are you?
I'm great. Where are you calling to us from in the world?
I'm currently at Friday Harbor Labs in Washington.
Ah, so you're on the coast, aren't you?
Yes. I can see the ocean from my window.
You cannot. You cannot see the ocean.
Yes, because I'm on a tiny little island. So I've got the forest behind me and the ocean right in front of me, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
I've talked to two people today, two podcast guests, and you are now the third one that is on the ocean, and my jealousy is at an all-time high. I love the ocean. Where we live in Canada is in one of the prairie provinces. So we're like crazy landlocked, right? Like it's a 14-hour drive or you have to fly to the ocean.
Yeah,
it's just so cool. Are you from that area originally?
No, actually, I've always lived in landlocked states. So I lived in Illinois until I was 10. And then I lived in the middle of the desert in Arizona until about 3 years ago.
Illinois is more landlocked than Arizona. Like Arizona, or am I wrong? Arizona is, you can go west.
Arizona is definitely closer to the ocean, but in Illinois we have Lake Michigan. So I don't know.
That's like, true.
What do you prefer?
Desert or a lake, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I have been asking guests lately, also about coronavirus. Has you and your family been okay with that, or has there been some stressors because of it?
There's definitely been some stressors. So I'm actually an employee at Howard University right now. I'm a lab technician, and I came home for my brother's wedding on March 15th, and then after the wedding, I couldn't really go back. So I had to work through with my boss trying to get all of my stuff back somehow, which was kind of frustrating, but we worked it out. And I have a family member that currently has COVID and they're in the hospital right now, but she's doing pretty well and her treatments are working. So looking like we're going to make a recovery, which is fantastic.
Okay. I know it's kind of a serious subject, but it's touching everybody in North America.
Yeah.
And I'm always curious when I ask our American friends how they're doing just from, because we, in our news, especially, like, I'm not sure exactly when this podcast will be out, but right now you've got some states that are surging.
Yeah.
So we just hope everybody's safe that we talk to and that we know. So
yeah, definitely. I appreciate that.
Well, okay. So let's take a turn here. Could you tell everybody about what you've taken for your undergrad and your educational experience? And you're a lab tech right now, but previous to that, people would be fascinated to know.
Sure. Yeah. So in undergrad, I took a lot of biology and like wildlife classes. So I took mammalogy, the study of mammals. I took vertebrate zoology. I took marine biology, all those different classes. And ecology. And ecology had a 6-hour field trip lab where we kind of conducted our own studies and did analysis and wrote papers, which some people might think is not super fun, but I thought it was an absolute blast. I did a lot of classes like that just to kind of get a feel for, you know, wildlife, learn a lot about different species and different groups and get some experience in the field, which, I mean, it was, again, kind of a mountain or the desert. So not necessarily the field that I wanted to be in, but it was still great experience and it was a lot of fun.
So you were, did you, was that in Arizona?
Yes.
I'm sorry if I got, oh, okay.
Yeah, I went to school at Northern Arizona University, and it is in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is a mountain surrounded by desert.
So you trekked out into the desert for your field study, and there's obviously animals that live there, but I don't know. Was that the gist of that one, your ecology study?
Yeah, so we did one of our field trips. We took out to a place called Hochtifer Hills, which is like a big forested area, and we got to see a whole bunch of cool animals. My study with my group was actually on trees, and we did tree coring and counted tree rings and stuff, which I thought was super fun. And then our other one that we went to, I don't remember what the field site was called, but it was kind of like an active volcanic area, but it had like a lot of volcanic rock and was a deserty area and had a lot of, just like small bushes, not like a lot of big trees and everything. So it was cool to see those two very different environments, not too far away from each other, but both of my studies I thought were super, super fun.
That is hard work coring a tree, isn't it?
My arm I've done that for so long.
I've done that before, and I'm a big guy and I lift weights, and I was just totally destroyed from coring a tree. I was like, who does this for a living? Those like ranger people that do that, they must just have jacked forearms. Like, I don't know. For people who are listening, and coring a tree is like this giant drill that you have to like go in. Did you use the drill thing?
One of those like hand turning
drill
type things. Yeah. And it was so, they were these huge like pine trees, and it was so, they were so thick, and you had to get like halfway through. Otherwise you wouldn't
get
all the rings. And then it was so difficult, especially me being, you know, not a very large person, kind of small and not super strong. I was like, this is a great workout.
You don't need to do Pilates or yoga. They just go core some trees.
Yeah, go core some trees.
Go. That's why those biologists that the field ecologists are always in such good shape, because they got to like walk everywhere and core trees.
Yes,
nature's workout. My other question for you is: you now are all in on stuff in the ocean, but before that, what was your draw to biology? Like you went into post secondary after high school, obviously. Did you always like sciences when you were a kid?
Yeah, science has always been my favorite subject. Whether it's like I love doing like little chemistry experiments when I was a kid, you know, the baking soda volcano I thought was super fun. But I was always really drawn to like animals. And so me and both of my brothers all majored in biology. And when we were kids, we would go outside and we would, after it rained, we would pick up the worms off of the sidewalk and feed them to our pet turtle. Or we would go out and find frogs and place them in a place where we knew that they weren't going to get harmed. Like they would get stuck in the fire escapes of people's houses. So we would go down and get them out and rehome them so that they wouldn't get trapped down there. We used to like get spiders to come out of their webs and then put them in a tank and just kind of observed them, which was, I mean, now looking back at it, I'm terrified of spiders. So I was like, why did I do that? But my brothers and I always were super interested in animals and just kind of would observe them and just loved being outside with them. So that's always been a big part of who I am. So it just kind of translated into what I want to do as a career.
That's super cool. Now, did you have parents or like a grandparent that also was like loved nature, or was it kind of the thing you got kicked out of the house, like go have fun? You're like, well, let's find some help, some frogs today.
It's funny because my aunt, my dad's sister, looked at the three of us and was like, I don't know where you three came from, because nobody else biology in our family. Like my mom is a math teacher. My dad's a police officer. My grandmother was a chemistry teacher, and like nobody in our family like did anything like this. And the three of us were just like, wow, animals are the coolest thing on the planet. And sure, my mom had pets when she was little, and she's always liked the environment and thought that it was really cool and likes being outside, but she's never been like, oh my gosh, I have to go learn about all these animals and interact with them. And my dad didn't even have pets growing up, because that's just not what his family did. So him seeing us get so invested in the environment now and being so interested in animals, it's like he's learning a lot about them as well. And I think that that's really fun. But yeah, like my brothers and I are just kind of like the odd bunch of like random people in the family. And everyone else is like, okay, cool. This is interesting. I'll learn from you guys.
That's awesome. It's perplexing, but they must be proud.
Yes, they're super excited to see what we're all doing.
That's awesome. Now, you had mentioned that you are a lab tech and you are going into, or I had said you were going into the aquatic fisheries program, and that's ocean stuff. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's your draw to the ocean from living your life in a landlocked area?
I feel like part of it comes from just the curiosity of something that I've never really had the chance to experience. But another part of it is that I'm just so obsessed with being in the water. I was a competitive diver in high school, actually for like 7 or 8 years. I was a competitive diver and I did Parks and Rec. I did high school dive and I did a little bit of club dive as well. And I just love being in the water. I always tried to jump into the big kid pool before I even knew how to swim because I just convinced myself that I knew how to swim. And my mom was like, I don't want to have to keep jumping in to save your life. Why do you keep jumping in here? You know you can't swim. That's just how I've always been. I'm just like, yeah, the water, this is the place for me. I'm just going to jump right in. And like, that's just how I've always been. So yeah, I think part of it is definitely just like part of who I am is super interested in the ocean and the water. And I want to know more about it. And the other part of it is probably just the curiosity of being like, I've never had the experience to interact with the ocean or its animals before because I've lived in landlocked states. So like, why don't I turn this curiosity into a career?
That's so interesting you mentioned that. I kind of know where you're coming from because I was a competitive swimmer as well when I was young. And all of the bodies of water I would swim in were like, there was no animals, right? You're right. In a pool. If you see an animal, it's probably like a bug or like, you know, something that probably shouldn't be there and it's got to get scooped out. And then the whole pool's got to be evacuated kind of thing. And then when I got to places like the ocean where you can snorkel and you can see what's in there or just the amount of life that's in the ocean, it was just like, it's like magic almost. It's every day is a thrill. Do you snorkel?
So I haven't been to the coast enough to, like, I haven't been to the coast a ton of times, so I haven't really had the chance to, you know, jump in and go snorkeling or go scuba diving.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
In the past, when my family and I have gone to California for a vacation, we went to like Seal Beach and we bought children's goggles because that's all they had at the convenience store. And we were like, let's just swim them around for a while. So my brothers and I, like, it was kind of snorkeling, but we didn't. It was just us swimming around with goggles in the ocean. So, I mean, it was super fun for sure, but I want to get more experiences like that for sure.
Oh, okay. I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that. I apologize.
No worry. I feel like a lot of people just assume that I've had tons of experience scuba diving and snorkeling in the ocean. And I'm like, fun fact, I've never been scuba diving in the ocean and I've not snorkeled very often. So, but I mean, I definitely want to. That's just not something that I've been able to do yet because I've lived in Arizona. So
yeah, there's not a lot of opportunities to go snorkeling in Arizona unless exactly. You're in a pool. As you're moving forward with your education career, you're going to be a grad student. What are you hoping to work on in research?
So my goal is to work with elasmobranch movement ecology. So I want to look at sharks and stingrays and where they are going in the world and why they're going there. What are they doing while they're there? I haven't picked a project just yet, like a specific dissertation project just yet, because I haven't like gotten like classes and everything haven't started. So I haven't gotten to that point yet, but I have like a few project ideas, but they're all just kind of, you know, movement ecology and seeing where these animals are going, which is super, super exciting to me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. It's cool that you have kind of like an overarching goal. I know a lot of grad students are like, yeah, I'm just going forward and we'll see what happens. You're pursuing a master's and maybe past that. Yeah, is that the plan?
Yeah, I'm shooting for a PhD just because I know that the work that I want to do later on will most likely require me to have a PhD. So it's just easiest to just go forward and jump right in and get my PhD.
And keep on swimming.
Yeah, just keep swimming.
That's cool. That's very, you know, it's exciting that you have that giant goal. I always tell folks that are going past their undergrad, I have such respect for you because I stopped after my undergrad. I have an undergrad in chemistry and then I have a second degree in education. And I just, I, the research to me is just so outside of what my brain could even handle. It's just like writing papers and things like that. So right. I have a lot of respect for people that's in their wheelhouse. So good for you.
Thank you.
One of the other things I was going to ask you is you shoot these amazing TikTok videos that are so full of whimsy and humor about various aquatic animals. Sometimes they're not aquatic animals. And how on earth did you decide to start that?
These videos are so much fun to make. So I was on TikTok for a while, and TikTok is full of a bunch of like high schoolers, middle schoolers, college kids doing these ridiculous dances or pulling pranks or telling their parents puns just to see their reactions and stuff like that. And I've seen a lot of people have like their specific thing that they like to do. I've seen artists. I saw one artist that draws each state as if they were a person, or people painting their walls with different Disney characters, and every day they reveal a new one or something like that. So I was like, I want to have a thing like that. So since I'm a scientist and I work with animals and I love animals, maybe I should just start showing people how awesome animals are. And there's another motivation behind it, just more than just making people laugh. I think education is a huge key to conservation. So if someone doesn't know about an animal, how are they expected to care enough to make movements towards conservation? So I figured I could do all these different animals, whether they're charismatic or not so charismatic, like spiders or worms or insects, snakes. Even a lot of people don't love snakes. And I just think that all these animals deserve so much respect. And so I figured I should make these videos, make people laugh, have fun in the process, and just kind of teach people like how cool these animals are and some fun facts about them to get them to be like, oh, this is a really interesting animal. We should make sure it's doing well. Yeah, that's just kind of my motivation behind it. Just want to show everyone the wonders of the natural world.
Well, first off, I'm super impressed you've figured out TikTok. I have not. I've got a Bunsen account on TikTok, and I just don't know what to do with it. It's just outside. It's so outside what I can think of. I think I just missed the boat age-wise to figure out TikTok. My students were big into TikTok before COVID hit, doing the dances, right? They were always like trying to do, if they got their work done, it was like a big reward. They're like, hey, can we have, like, we're done. Can we like do 4 minutes? Can we just practice our TikTok dance? I'm like, oh my goodness. I'm like, fine. At least you're not texting on your, you go do your dances.
That's so funny.
Is your personality in the videos like your authentic self, or is it you're putting on as an act?
I would say that it's pretty close to who I am. Just like the excitement and the jokes, and like I that's just kind of who I am. And when I think of something funny or like some weird adaptation, I'll make a joke about it. Sometimes my family will just roll their eyes and like, that wasn't even funny. And I'm like, well, I was entertained. So that's just kind of like what I do. I just, you know, make jokes and have fun with it and just be excited and enthusiastic. Like, that's just pretty much who I am.
How do you edit that? Because like, you're giving across some really good information, and but you have these like crazy zoom effects, which are part of the, I don't know. I watch it. I'm like, how is she doing? It's so funny. Like when you have a specific point to make and you put your finger up and it like zooms in perfectly. It's brilliant. How do you edit that? Or is that a trade secret you don't want to tell people?
The zoom effect is actually super, super easy. So it's like, it's super similar to Snapchat. And I've used Snapchat for a super long time, where basically if you just, you have your finger on the record button and you just swipe it up, it'll just zoom in. So that's just kind of what I do. And I don't know.
Oh, it's on TikTok itself. It's on the TikTok app, that yeah. ability. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So when I'm recording, it just, you swipe your finger up and it just zooms in. And so I don't know why I started doing that. I feel like a lot of people do that to like emphasize a point or like add a little punchline or something. So I just started doing that at the end of basically every sentence. Like, and now I just do it involuntarily all the time. So
I love it when it's absolutely random. My favorite is like, you normally do it like it's a point. But then sometimes it'll be like in the middle of a sentence, and it just, I don't know. I think it's brilliant. They're really funny. What has the response been from your friends and your family?
It's been really, really good. My family loved them. I've gotten my brothers to be in one of them. It was funny because I did the giant Pacific octopus, and then my brother just popped in to say, "It's giant." And then the next day, I did the giant Chinese salamander, and my other brother popped in to say, "It's also giant." And I don't know why it was so funny, but it was so funny to me. And I've gotten some friends.
That's a callback. That is high level humor right there, where you call back to a previous joke.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's really good.
No, that's okay. I've gotten family and friends to be in them. I've gotten my nephew, he's two, to be in a few of them and just like make whatever sound the animal that I'm talking about would make. People really love that too. I think my family definitely loves it, but I got a lot of new followers on both TikTok and Twitter because of these videos. Like when I started these videos, I had probably around 400 followers on Twitter, and now I have 19,000 followers, and it happened so fast. It was ridiculous. And I'm not the type of person to be like, oh yeah, I want all the followers for the attention, but like, it's nice to know that I have a lot of people listening because it means that I'm reaching more people with my videos, and I'm able to show more people that the natural world is really important. So that's why I get excited about, you know, follower count.
Yeah, no, the follower count is important because it expands your platform.
Right.
Of course it gives you a little ego boost, right? You're like, ooh, look at that. That's nice. Yeah. But then you know your message is reaching 18,000 more people for you than a couple months ago or whenever. Right. I think I found you from there's a biologist named Karina Newsom that was on the podcast that I follow. Yeah. I adore her. Retweeted. Yeah, she's awesome. She like retweeted you. She's like, look at this or something like that. It was hilarious. I laughed. I was like, who, this is the funniest thing. So I'm just so glad you're on the podcast talking about it. And we'll have links to your Twitter so people can see some of your videos. And you're only a click away from some of these. They are brilliant. And you learn so much too. I'd prefer to learn from you about these facts than like even like anything on YouTube. They're just so good.
Thank you. Congratulations.
I know they must be a lot of work. They must take like a day to edit and put together.
Honestly, it doesn't even take that long. I collect all my facts, and then I get like pictures, and then I film it, and I add captions, and then I post it, and all of that together probably only takes like, I don't know, between 45 minutes to an hour and a half, depending on the species, how much information is out there, or how many times that day I tend to be tripping over my words, because some days are way better than others, just in terms of like how well I can speak, I guess. The other thing is that I haven't sped these videos up. I just talk incredibly fast. And I do that in conversation with people as well and don't realize that I'm doing it. So that's just, I just can talk really fast. So if I'm tripping over my words, it's because I'm talking too fast and I have to slow myself down a little bit. But it doesn't take all that long for me to film these, actually. A lot of people assume that it takes multiple days or like a few hours, but it really doesn't take that long at all.
Nice. Nice. That's great. You're efficient.
Thank you.
It takes me a bit longer to put a podcast show together, but
I would
when I first started, it was like, how do I edit this? Like, what is Audacity? But you learn as you go. And maybe I should revisit TikTok if it has all of these awesome editing features. I don't know. The main thing I use, this is so embarrassing. The main thing I do with TikTok is I look at it. I'm like, okay, what is happening here? Oh, that looks like a popular kind of trend. And I just steal it and try to put shoehorn Bunsen content into it. Cause I don't even know. And, and then you can use music that is copyrighted on TikTok. That's the cool thing about TikTok.
Yeah, like you can, which is really unique.
That's awesome talking to you about those videos. And the impetus behind them is spreading really good information, biological information for conservation. And that's a noble effort.
Thank you.
One of the things we always ask our guests about in the middle of the podcast is for a pet story, because everybody likes listening to guest stories about animals that they've had or interactions with them in their life. Do you have a pet story you could share with us?
Yes. So I have three pets. None of them are currently with me in Washington, but every time I go back home, I'm very, very excited to see them. And they're all very excited to see me as well. So I have an Eastern Box Turtle. She's such a sweetheart. My favorite thing about her is that she's shy. So when I bring her outside to get some sun, she'll poke her head out first, but keep all of her limbs inside. And she'll just kind of look around and just look like a little potato with a head. And then she'll stick her limbs out and start adventuring, which I think is really, really cute. And I have two miniature schnauzers. One's named Apollo and one's named Taz. And they are so, so cute. Yeah.
What was the first schnauzer's name?
Apollo.
Oh, Apollo. Oh, that's cute.
Apollo and Taz. They are half brothers and they're getting kind of old. They're going to be 11 this year. But Apollo is so... he's so chilled out and tolerant of people messing with him, which is wonderful because my 2-year-old nephew just loves to mess with him and he'll just let it happen all day long. But he is such a goof because he tried to squeeze himself between a bookcase and a desk and got stuck. And I had no idea how long he was stuck. I just thought he was messing around in the other room. And I go in there and he's stuck between this desk and a bookcase and just looked at me like, please help. I've been here for 10 minutes. Like, what do I do now? And I was like, you are so ridiculous. So had to help him out of that situation. He's been in so many situations like that. He loves getting himself stuck. He's gotten himself stuck behind my dresser multiple times. He's ridiculous. And then Taz is just such, we named him Taz because he's crazy. He's a spaz. We call him Taz the Spaz, but he's such a he's very irritating in the cutest way. My brother hates it, but I think it's so funny. He will, like any other dog, like bother you if you're not petting him, but he will nudge your hand with his nose. And if you still don't pet him, he will start pawing at you. And if you still don't listen, he will audibly yell at you until you start petting him or until you hide your hands and he goes to find a different set of hands. Like, he's the moodiest dog I've ever met in my entire life.
That's hilarious. They have such different personalities.
Yeah, very different, but they're the best of friends and they're inseparable. If you try to take one for a haircut and the other one stays home, they're going to freak out. So you got to bring them both together.
Aw. Our two dogs, Bunsen and Beaker, the little one, our golden puppy, she is just like attached to Bunsen at the hip. It's pretty cute to see when dogs bond like that. It's awesome.
That's so cute. Yes, that's my favorite thing is a good animal friendship and just seeing how much they bond and they're just the best friends and oh, it warms my heart.
And it is tough. Like you're away from home and it is tough to have pets at that time.
Yeah.
Do you travel back home often or is it kind of a holiday type thing?
So when I was at Northern Arizona University, I would go home more because it was only like a 2.5-3 hour drive. So my senior year when I had a car, I would drive home for like things like my nephew's birthday or for a long weekend or things like that. So I could hang out with my family and see my dogs. But now that I'm further away, I'm in Washington and I'll be in Seattle soon. I'll only be able to go home really for holidays, which, like I totally get it. Airfare is expensive. So I don't want to have to, you know, pay the airfare to go home, no, as often as I'd like to, but yeah. And I'm a big holiday person, so it's always really nice to go home for holidays. So it's still a decent deal. I'll take it.
Oh, okay. That's awesome. The dogs will be so happy to see you.
Oh, they get so excited. They will attack my face with kisses every single time I come home. It doesn't matter if I'm gone for 5 months or 5 minutes. They will lose their minds when I come back in the door. And they're like, you were gone forever. It's so funny.
Well, thanks for sharing your pet story with us. My father-in-law has a miniature schnauzer too. And they're pretty cuddly dogs. Like they're lap dogs, right? They're little small things.
Yeah, so they are. They're so cute.
They can bounce around. They've got hops too for being so small.
Yeah.
Man, can they jump? Like they're for being small, they got some pretty good springs.
Yeah. Taz can jump very high, but Apollo only gets a few inches off the ground. He can't even get up on the couch anymore. He does not have hops.
Is it because he's older or he just never could jump?
He always would jump from a distance that was way further than he ought to have jumped from and then face plant on the couch. So I think then after that, he just kind of gave up. And now that he's older, like, it's not helping. But I think he was like, I'm just tired of failing. So I'll just sit on the floor by your feet. I'm comfortable with this.
That's funny. It's really funny how different dog breeds can jump completely differently.
Yeah.
Like Bunsen, he's a Bernese Mountain Dog. He's huge and he can jump, but he launches, like he can't jump high. So we did this. I wish I videotaped it. Like we trapped him with paper towel tubes. So we just like made a fortress of paper towel around him. You know, like those Bounty, I don't know what they are, like paper towels.
Yeah.
They're whatever. Yeah. So we made like fortress paper towel around him and he was just stuck. He's like, this is me now. Like that was his life. He was trapped in fortress tower, fortress paper tool. And then our Golden, who's still a puppy, she can outjump Bunsen easily, but it's just because they're a more athletic breed. They were built for, I think, being faster than pulling carts. So yeah. That's funny.
That's so funny. Yeah.
One of the other things we always ask our guests for is the super fact. And the super fact, and your videos are so full of super facts, but the super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, I kind of just like, it breaks their brain. They just can't handle it. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do. It's about sharks. I think that this fact, it's kind of like a string of facts, but people think that sharks are these aggressive and vicious creatures that will like kill a human on sight. And that is just the furthest thing from the truth. My fact is that you are more likely to be killed by a cow, a vending machine, a coconut falling on your head, or a flying champagne cork than you are to be killed by a shark. All things that you don't even think about in your daily life. Like, I mean, a coconut to the head or a vending machine, really. But you're more likely to be killed by one of those than by a shark. And I think that people think that's the most ridiculous thing. And it is kind of ridiculous, but that's the truth. They're not super vicious, randomly aggressive animals. The only reason they really attack people is if they're, you know, they're curious as to what you are, or you might look like prey, or they're not inherently aggressive or evil or whatever. But that's my fun fact. And I think it makes a lot of people laugh.
It's terrible. How on earth would you get killed from a champagne cork? Like, there must be some,
I don't know.
That's since you must have to just get hit just right. Like, oh my goodness. Yeah. What kind of.
Not a great situation.
No, that's terrible. I can see the vending machine one though, because I teach high school kids and sometimes this has probably happened to you, Jada. You've bought a snack and it gets jammed.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you're like, stupid machine. And of course, high school kids don't have the coping skills that everybody else has, but maybe they're hypoglycemic and they're really hungry for their chips or whatever they've bought. So they'll attack the machine or shake it. And I can see that, the vending machine falling on somebody whose snack got stuck.
Yeah,
I don't know why the kids at our school really like the stuff that's in it, because we have the health protocol in Alberta. So there can only be X amount of sugar or fat in all the snacks in the school. So all of the potato chips are like the baked potato chips that taste like cardboard. But man, I guess when you're starving, the cardboard chips are something else.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a cool super fact. That's good to know about sharks for people that are scared to go in the water. My uncle, he's that way. That's the reason he won't go in the ocean. I'm like, you know, what I tell him is like, do you know what the chances of getting killed by a shark are if you were wading in the ocean? He's like, well, I'll tell you, they're a lot better if I'm on land. I'm like, okay, touche. You're right, but you're also wrong. What's that?
My dad has the same argument. He's like, oh, well, nothing bad can happen to me in the ocean if I just don't go in the ocean. And I'm like, that's fair. That's accurate. I can't get mad at you for that because you're right.
But watch where you stand. Watch where you stand, because the coconuts could get you.
Exactly.
So something could happen. I've got ammunition now, Jada. I am so glad I've talked to you today. That's a great super fact. I really enjoy the last question we've been asking guests is we've given our guests a little bit of, I don't really call it a soapbox, but we've given them the opportunity to talk about something that they're passionate about, be it a cause or be it something like a TV show they'd like to talk about. You have this interesting thing, organization you've started called MISS, which stands for Minorities in Shark Sciences. Can you talk to everybody about that?
Yeah. So this was an organization started by me and three other Black female shark scientists, Jasmine Graham, Amani Weber-Schultz, and Carly Jackson. So the four of us have kind of gone through our entire academic career and our significant portions of our lives, in some cases, realizing that we are the only person of color or the only Black person in a room, which can be kind of uncomfortable at times, depending on who you are. And we realized that there's not a ton of diversity in the shark science world. And so we started this program to give more women of color, to show them that they also belong in this field. It's not just a place for white men. And we want to be able to increase diversity in this field for a bunch of different reasons. One, because diversity in people, like lived experiences or ways of life, will create diversity in thought. And if you have diversity in thought, you're going to come up with a lot more discoveries and ideas. So I think without that, the scientific community in general is going to lose out on a lot of information that they could be collecting otherwise. We also want to give these women of color and people of color in the scientific community, like a community within the community, to feel more accepted and have a place to go to when maybe there's an issue happening, a place that they can just feel comfortable and get resources. And also, we want to make sure that we're breaking down these financial barriers that a lot of people, especially people of color, run into when trying to get into fields like this. So we are collecting donations so that we can fund the travel of all of our program participants out to Miami to live on a boat for 2 days and go snorkeling and shark tagging and be able to get some experience without having to go through like an unpaid internship or paying someone to come out and work for them, which is a thing that we see sometimes. Like, and that's never really, it's definitely good experience, but not everyone can do that because maybe they don't have the funds for that. So we wanted to make sure that we're breaking down any social and financial barriers that people like us would potentially face and just get more diversity in shark sciences and marine biology, because diversity is great. And we want to see everyone included because everyone has great ideas.
That's such an amazing point. I was talking to another scientist and a while back, it was before I started the podcast, and what she said to me really, it made me stop and think, because like, I'm a middle-aged white guy from Canada, so I have all of the privilege in the world. My nation, my country is really privileged. My skin color gives me privilege. My economic status gives me privilege. And she's like, can you imagine how much more advanced science would be today if everybody was included?
Right.
And that's just not just like allowing women to participate in science. That's allowing people of color who are also women to participate in science, or people of color to participate in science. And it was mind blowing for me at the time. It changed my whole outlook. And your organization just sounds fantastic. I would so much rather watch you on Shark Week explain stuff than whoever else they've got. So I hope that's something that comes your way in the future as doors are open for everybody. So anyway, yeah. or if you so choose.
I think it's really awesome because the first like 3 days after our launch, we've already raised almost $20,000.
What?
And then
congratulations.
Thank you. And now coming to, I think today we got an update. We're at $23,000 and our goal is $25,000. So that's for like the rest of the year. So we're so, so close to meeting our goal. And all that money is going to help minorities in shark sciences and women of color in sciences. And I think it's just really awesome and we're really, really excited about it. So if you would like to donate, our donation link is www.misselasmo.org/donate.
Oh, all right. And you know what? As I've always said to the listeners, the link will be in our show notes. So I'll get that from Jada. You are one click away from going to the website, so you don't have to try and remember all that. But I wrote it down too.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, you must be just so excited of the support that you got. That's amazing.
Yeah, definitely. It's super awesome to see a whole bunch of people come together for one really good cause.
Yeah, you were giving me goosebumps as you were talking about it. I'm just so inspired. I'm glad that we had this conversation about this organization.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Jada, have you had negative experiences because of your skin color in science or in your journey to get where you are?
So for me, it's mostly been like smaller microaggressions, which are definitely just as frustrating. But I've gotten a lot of comments of like, oh, you want to work in the ocean, haha, but black people can't swim. And I'm like,
oh my goodness,
that's not a funny joke. it's like, there was no reason to make that comment. I don't really understand why you did. Most of the places that I grew up have been predominantly white spaces. So I'm very, I don't want to say comfortable because it's not necessarily comfortable to be the only person of color in a room, but I'm used to it at this point. So it's usually just small things like that for me. I know that other people have definitely experienced more aggressive forms of racial biases and racism. I did have one person tell me that I got my scholarship to NAU because of my skin color. And he was a straight white man. I am none of those things. So I was like, okay. And he was basically telling me that I had black privilege and women privilege and that I got to where I was because of affirmative action and things like that. But I want you to keep in mind that this scholarship was a GPA-based scholarship. So it had nothing to do with my skin color. And I'm just good at school. Like, that's just, I know.
You just kicked ass to get there. That's how you got there.
Right. Thank you. And I was like, I worked really hard to get to where I am. And maybe not everybody's good at school, but that happens to be one of my strong suits. So I did have a really good GPA and that's why I got the scholarship. And I was just like, I'm not even having this conversation with this person. I'm going to block him. There's no reason. I'm not going to change his mind. It's going to be a waste of my time. So I was just like, okay, whatever. You can think what you want to think, but I know what the truth is. I know that I've worked hard to get to where I am and that I, as a black woman in the LGBT community in science, like, all of that is relevant to who I am and how I conduct my science. So if you want to talk crap about me, that's fine. I'm going to keep doing what I need to do because science needs me. So yeah.
We do. We so need you. We so need you. I can't imagine a world without your videos now. So
thank you.
I so appreciate you sharing that little bit of tidbit for everybody that's listening.
Yeah, cool.
Not everybody in life has the same experiences. And the best we can do sometimes is just listen.
Right. Definitely. Just like kind of trying to understand and work to help people and use the privilege that you may have to help people that might not have that privilege.
I'm just kind of at a loss for words because I'm just heartbroken that anybody would say something like that to you. But I'm just so glad that you have the internal fortitude to just keep going on and do great things and end up where you are today. So that's also very amazing on your part.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Well, we're kind of at the end of the interview, Jada. Thank you so much for talking to us on the podcast with things that are very so positive and fun and whimsical with your videos and the excitement of your future with your research in sharks. I had hoped to ask you again in a couple of years and we could talk maybe more about what you've discovered.
Sure.
and again, for the folks that are listening, make sure you check out the links in the show notes for some of the links to the content that Jada's made. It's hard to get it across in podcast form. It's definitely an audio visual experience. There we go. Where can people find you on social media, Jada?
You can find me on Twitter at Sophistication.
I love it.
I can't even say the word normally anymore because I'm so used to saying sophistication, which I think is really funny. I'm on TikTok at Jada Elcock, just my name, no spaces, no underscores, anything like that. And then on Instagram, I am at baby_Elcock because I am the youngest of my siblings. Yeah.
I love it. It's great.
Follow the other Miss ladies. They are wonderful and they have a lot of fun content. I know that Amani is drawing different animals and how they might wear pants. That's with like dogs and cats. So she's done it with sharks and crabs and all kinds of ridiculous animals. And I think that that's just super fun. And all of us Miss ladies have a lot of fun content. And also Karina Newsom, I know that you've had her on the podcast before, but she is just an absolute gem of a human being and a gem of a time.
She is.
And I 10 out of 10 recommend following her as well.
Yeah, she's an all-star. Yeah. You're an all-star too.
Thank you.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the pants thing. That literally derailed a chemistry class I was teaching because some kid's like, Mr. Zed, put up the search. How do giraffes wear pants or something like that, right? Or was it was a shirt or, no, it was a tie. How do giraffes wear a necktie?
And I
normally at the start of class, like I show a couple memes and then we get right to it. And I was like, okay. And 30 minutes of my freaking class was gone because of this giraffe wearing a tie. Like where does a giraffe wear his tie? Like up around underneath his chin or down on like his breastbone? So I'm curious to see these pants, these animal pants things. I can't wait.
They're super funny.
All right. Well, speaking of a gem, this was a gem of an interview. And thank you again for talking to us on the podcast.
Of course. Thank you so, so much for having me.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN 10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Science is for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam.
So, it's story time again on the podcast this episode. My section, which is story time. And if you don't know what story time is because you forgot or because you're new, story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the story time timeline of relevancy. So, we're going to be talking about stories that have happened. And yeah, Mom, do you have any stories?
My mouth has to be way closer.
No, that's good.
That's good now. I sure do. I have a story about when we were on the beach. We went to the Vancouver Island and we were on a beach that we had not been on before. And it's called
Wiccanish Beach.
It's called Wiccanish Beach. And it's actually a fluke that we found it. And that's a little bit of a story in itself. But there we were. And Bunsen's favorite trick is to lay down. It's the craziest thing because he's a little bit lazy, and so he just likes to keep his bulk on the ground. So the perfect solution to the little golden bitey piranha was to attach her to him. So they were attached together and he was like the big brother babysitter and she would be running around and digging, dig, 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 dig and get sand on him and he would just look at her and be like, ugh. Oh my goodness. But then she's a puppy, so she got tired. And so he would just sit there and she would sit there too and sleep, which was super cute.
Sandy beaches. I don't know why I said that, but Dad, do you have a story?
So where we were staying, there was this awesome little cove that we went to and we rented paddle boards and learned to paddleboard. It's like a giant surfboard that you stand up on all the time. It's called a SUP stand-up paddleboard. And I was very terrible to start with, and Adam was very, very good. I fell in probably a dozen times until I figured it out. And I figured it out, and then I took Beaker out with me, and it was so fun, and she was so good. She held her balance for almost the entire trip, and then she saw some seaweed and jumped off the side. And I think she was a little shocked how cold the ocean was. So I did fall in then because she jumped out and then I tried to like reach in and haul her out and the balance was all off. I didn't have practice hauling in a wet, soggy dog on something I just learned to do. So I fell in. So we both fell in the ocean and I put her back up and we paddleboarded back. And then near the shore, I think she saw Chris and she just like dove off the front of the paddleboard and swam the rest of the way as I paddleboarded in. It was so cute. And we're going to be getting paddleboards because it was so fun. And I can see Beaker being the dog at the front of the paddleboard, no problem. Bunsen, not so much. He doesn't like to get that wet, and he's super big, so probably would pose a bounce problem. That's my story.
All right, Dad, you keep making your excuses for that you fell in. But now it's my turn to say my story, and my story is a fun story. We went on a couple hikes at Vancouver Island, and I would jump like off of the like trail a little bit, like onto trees that had fallen or the trees that had been chopped down or something like that. And I would just jump onto them, do some fun parkour and stuff like that. But Beaker really wanted to come with me. And if she was off leash, she would probably be fine and she would probably come with me. But she was on leash and she wasn't too happy about not being able to come with me. So she barked at me because she was like, I want to go up there too. I want to jump around.
She tried to jump onto that log and didn't make it.
She didn't make it, but we caught her just in time before she like fell off. Because like it was on a wooden platform a little bit and it was a wooden walkway all the way and it was pretty cool. But Beaker fell off of that because she wanted to jump on a log that I was on. But yeah, that's been story time. Tune in next week on my section for story time or something like that. And yeah, I will see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
And that's the end of another podcast episode. Thanks so much for listening. We had a great time out on the West Coast. We made a lot of great memories. We took a lot of great pictures. But we're happy to be home. You can probably hear Beaker barking in the background. At the end of the podcast, we always give a special shout out to our special patrons, the top tier patrons who make running the podcast so much easier. And they are... Take it away, Chris.
Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Shelby Leggett, Daniel Fry, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Judith Morton, Karen Beth St. George, Catherine Lynch, Kathleen Zerker, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Ben Rathert, Liz Button, and Rebecca Rutherford.
Also, special thanks to biologist Jada Elcock, who also runs all those fun TikTok videos. Check them out in the show notes. Let's end with the dog's motto. For science, empathy, and cuteness.